All right, so the anxiety of performance-related issues, when will our papers be due, et cetera, is beginning to come up. So let me just return to the basic principles of housekeeping for a moment. The minimum work in this course is 2 essays, not ever longer than 1,000 words under any circumstances, and at least 2 drafts, never less than 2 drafts under any circumstances. I have to sequence the editing involved with some care. There will be, I'm not sure, the more people actually still enrolled in this course than are sitting in these seats at the moment, but let us assume it is 62 as the register says, and I have 38 first years, let's call that 100, times 1,000 words twice in 2 drafts each is 400,000 words of editing. So I have a job to do allocating the time necessary for those purposes, and that's got to fit into each work week through the term. And then, of course, there's the fact that you're allowed to do your rewriting when you feel like, and so I can't totally control the flow of writing. I would guess that it would be convenient for me if the first drafts of your first essays were available in the first week of March. I think that means the first year class will go first and produce some writing in the last week of February, and you'll produce some writing in the first week of March. The second essay's first draft will be due late in March or early in April. Your rewriting is due at the end of the term before grades are required to be submitted, or if you're not graduating, when you feel like it, we'll talk about that further. But to the extent that you want to understand the flow of your own work, I would suggest that you would be wise to plan on producing one draft of a 1,000-word essay at the beginning of March and another 1,000-word draft of a second essay at roughly the beginning of April. And we'll try and make that more precise as we go along, but I will set no more punitive deadlines than that. Questions about housekeeping? Questions left over from last week? Questions, objections, riposts, etc.? Well, all right, let us see if I can make things yet more annoying and create some need to ask a question or lodge an objection. I'll assume that I don't need to put the single sentence of the Fourth Amendment back up there, but if anybody feels out of touch with the words, let me know and I'll write it back up on a placard for us. So far, I have offered the following argument concerning the drift, the shape, the trajectory of Fourth Amendment law in the United States from the formation of the Constitution until now, and with respect to the value of the Fourth Amendment under 21st century conditions. I presented the following argument. The shape of search and seizure law and constitutional requirement in the United States is the outcome of a shared sociological condition between the world of the English law before American independence and American life after that, which is a comparatively low rate of available thuggery for government. The political economy of spying on people, of surveilling and of searching and of seizing and of punishing, the political economy of all of that executive power is poor in England from the earliest relevant times, and poor in the United States until the middle of the 20th century. Government's ability to use executive authority actually to interfere with, surveil, and bottle up human beings is low in both societies pretty much all the time. The consequence of which is that the availability of orders to get local constables or officials or inspectors or just the available free hands in law enforcement to do the work of searching and seizing, arresting, putting in jail, getting papers, searching for houses. All of that work can only be done by a relatively small number of people, and there have to be forms of order involved judicially to get those things done. The sort of people you can put on the budget that you can just go send in an unmarked van to do that work, those kinds of people don't exist across the long political history of the English-speaking people and in the United States. There is an exception to that in the United States for the force necessary to boss around and control and hurt persons who are regarded as of another order, unfree. But that exception, though it is large in the practical sense, is small conceptually, because the line between free persons and unfree persons, whether we are talking about in early English history or in the United States of the 19th century, the line is sharply delineated, and the law knows where its blanket exceptions are. With respect, then, to persons classified as free in a system of bilateral categorization. With respect to persons categorized as free, there's very little available thuggery power. And the consequence of that structure is a set of legal rules which believe that they can regulate that thuggery on behalf of the population pretty easily by pinching at the one place where the system is at its weakest, that is, its power to get person power to do its work. That's the essence of my historical proposition, that to understand the nature not only of the roots of the Fourth Amendment, but of its doctrine thereafter, the principle is that it represents an elegant way of controlling a serious problem, but one which is, from the point of view at least of free persons, unresourced enough that it can be addressed by cutting it at the spot where its stem meets its root, where the availability of people to do the work is at its is controllable. The other part of what I have had to say about the history of the Fourth Amendment is that its placiness, its emphasis upon physical locales, which is its strength under 18th century circumstances, is a drawback in a world of dematerialized conditions. That the specific is so important to the philosophy of the law that places and persons and particular circumstances must be delineated, that it takes so much of its strength from the particularity in three dimensions which it affords, which it requires, that the amendment comes to work against itself. The law that it has made comes to work against itself when those sharp criteria of place and thing are no longer useful. Not all of that no longer useful has to do with technological progress, but most of it does. The traditional limitation that arises from this form of particularity is the problem of plain sight. It's true that you can't have Dow Chemical against the United States without a helicopter that can fly over. But all of the binoculars cases and the flying over cases and all these other pieces are really an extension of an inherent limit, which is that the amendment is designed to protect thuggery which is aimed at the secrecy that human beings themselves create. It's at its hardest under the roof of the home. The mere framing of the home is in itself a special form of ritual for pushing thuggery away, like, you know, fireworks or loud noises to dispel evil spirits. The home has a sacred character. But even then, as Kilo shows, there's a philosophic question. Well, looking at the home is not a problem, right? Well, looking at the home in visual spectrum is okay, but maybe not in infrared spectrum because Well, we're not sure, but it's different. But where the law's placing us is to its advantage. Where the form of the particular that the amendment is centered around is at its best is, of course, in protecting against physical intrusion. Thuggery in the form of violence that breaks the close, that reduces, in the crucial word of the Fourth Amendment, security. And so you can see whether we're talking about the way in which the law of the Fourth Amendment responds to GPS, or the way in which it responds to the mobile phone, that the primary question is about intrusion. Jones works out the way it works out because they attached the GPS device to the car, the physical, a breaking of the semi-sacred, hardly sacred, but slightly sacred, circle around the automobile, and the much more sacred circle around the home. The physical interaction is where it becomes easy for even a Supreme Court that has no desire to hurt policemen to interfere with investigative behavior. They pushed something in. They hammered a microphone into a wall. They attached a thing to an automobile. They came within the precincts of the home, even if Kilo suggests that maybe there are some kinds of rays emanating from the home that you're not allowed to catch from the hill across the street. It's the act of entering past some membrane of constitutional importance. And that reminds us, when we watch the court deal with the consequences of 21st century technology by asking, but did they penetrate the home? Did they break the close? Did they physically invade? We can see the way in which that structure, the idea that there is this place over here where there is security and there is this place over here where there is no security, is so fundamental to the amendment that as changes in society change the importance of physical locale, they break the structure of doctrine and the nature of judicial thinking, and some fundamental alteration has to occur in order to, as we would be likely to say as lawyers looking from outside, to catch up with the circumstances. It's not a question of catching up, it's fundamental reinvention. The other part of the historical relationship between the unavailability of cheap thuggery and the nature of the law is that the law feels that it can avoid altogether discussion of the secret world. It's not that any of these societies had no secret world, that there are no secret police, that there is no political investigation, that there is no... But it is of such a slight character, there is so little of it. It lies at such a spot outside the realm of ordinary legal conversation that legal principle can afford to draw a sharp line altogether. We're not even thinking about spooks. We only live in a world of cops. And for most of the period in which this law develops, whether we are thinking about the long development in the history of English law or even the American development, it's not an unreasonable position. The spook element is even more underfunded than the cop element. There is even less of it, and it makes more sense to believe that a bright line can be drawn there, far more easily, in fact, than the bright line is drawn between free and unfree persons in society. The consequence of which is that the law develops not merely as though it could remain in ignorance of the secret world, but as though it can be hostile to the secret world, as though it can treat the secret world as a thing unknown to and irrelevant to, not above the law. There's just not enough of it to be afraid of in that sense. None of which is to ignore its existence, but to suggest something peculiar about the nature of the rule of law. You could take as a similar example the question of torture. The English common law's attitude concerning torture is one which is simply forbidding. Torture is not allowed. Torture has no role in the system of justice. There is no formal place for coercive examination under pains and penalties. It's not there. This, in contradistinction to the continental systems of the near countries on the other side of the ditches, where in France or in the Netherlands, in Spain or Italy, the descendants of the Roman law are systems which not just allow, but assume torture. This, too, is a historical development that comes from the same basic cycle, from forbidding to accepting in the Roman law itself. The law of the Roman Republic also regarded torture as unacceptable for Roman persons. Unfree persons, of course, live on the other side of a line, and those bodies are open to torture at all times. The empire is substantially well along before it begins to erode that distinction and subject citizens of the empire to torture. But by the time the Roman Empire fell, and certainly by the time the regimes of Western Europe had recovered their Romanness, the system of torture, that is, coercive interrogation for the purpose of securing admission of guilt, is a formal part of the law. And there's law about torture. That is to say, when is there enough evidence to allow you to torture somebody? All of which the English law simply rejects and behaves as though it had no knowledge of. It crosses on the other side of the street, which doesn't mean it isn't there. Yeah?
Didn't that sort of distinction between how you treat your citizens and how you treat non-citizens apply to the British Empire, too, though?
We are not now at the point where there is a substantial British Empire to discuss. And we can assume that anything said about English administrative behavior which imposes limitations on brutality will not be likely to be used in Ireland. But all of that is a much less important fact than the fact that the Scottish law knows torture to be usable procedurally in exactly the same way that continental European systems do. Here, in talking about the English common law, I'm not talking about the whole of the island, let alone places beyond. The Scottish legal order, with its strong civil law component, sees torture as an entirely acceptable part of criminal procedure, and for the same reason, under the same basic conclusions as the ones that the continental law would draw. For this, if you want to do some reading, The locus classicus is John Langline's book, Torture and the Law of Proof, which I would recommend to you as a good inquiry into what John calls Renaissance justice on both sides. As usual, he wishes to make it appear that English law and continental criminal procedure are more convergent than they appear to be. So you get the benefit of the kind of thinking that you're looking for right there. But for the moment, what I want to point to is the peculiar extra-legal status of torture in the English law, in the same way that the secret world is extra-legal to English criminal procedure and feeds the Fourth Amendment in that sense. John Selden, in his table talk, the talk of a witty and thoughtful mid-17th century English lawyer, Selden says, torture is never used as it is in England. In the continent, they use it in procedure as when there is half proof, and they rack somebody to make it full proof, which is an accurate statement of the nature of the law of proof and torture in 17th century French or Spanish or Dutch law. Here, it is used not in judicature, but when somebody bids. And Selden means by that that torture is a political act in England, that it is carried out by thugs of the crown, often indeed relatives of the crown, or the servants of relatives of the crown, that it's done secretly and when somebody bids, that is, only as a work of power, and therefore entirely outside the law. Punishable in theory, not permissible in fact, not a thing that can be the source of a royal a permission, or let alone an authorization, but it's just out there as a thing that occurs, and that the law knows not, and that the law has no reason or purpose to countenance. And for that purpose, I can say that it leaves things pretty much at the same level as counterintelligence, surveillance, snooping, mail opening, etc., etc. It's simply part of the extra-legal, non-constitutional activities of government. Out of that same ambivalence, then, grows two facts, both the tendency of the system to turn a blind eye to that which it doesn't rationalize. Since there is no place for torture in law, all torture is extra-legally conducted. None of it can ever speak its name or show its face. It cannot be used officially in procedure, just as the secret world is fundamentally distinct from any acts of government that are allowed by law or that are part of law enforcement or domestic order keeping. The same principle, in other words, which makes it possible for the law to ignore also makes it impossible for the law to accept. And thus we acquire a distinction, even fully fleshed out, even before we have need for it, that if the society's secret world grows large, if its possession of the power of political snooping becomes significant, still, that will remain not only outside the law, but forbidden to the law. And thus the peculiarity that the English-speaking legal systems, unlike those of the near neighbors, the European ones, the Latin American ones, and so on, the American legal system maintains a hard distinction between the spook and the cop, between law enforcement and domestic order keeping on the one hand and political intelligence gathering or dirty tricks of the kind on the other. And carried that distinction all the way through 20th century American law and into the period that we can think of as the Snowden Law. So this is the first of my propositions about how this law grows and how it functions and why it is subject to breakdown under the conditions of current networked society. The second point that grows out of the history is the crucial distinction between the security of persons in themselves, their houses, papers, and effects on the one hand, and the role of third parties on the other. As I've pointed out, the quintessential criminal activity being subjected to British imperial control in North America or subsequently federal control over the United States of America, the quintessential criminal activity is smuggling. Unlicensed commercial activity at the border. And as I have indicated, that is mostly in the United States before independence at the time that the Americans formed their constitutional conflicts with the British Empire. That is primarily about the smuggling of sugar. The location of barrels of molasses on which no tax has been paid in the basements of somebody who is storing that sugar as part of the commercial maritime or mercantile business of the Americans. That structure, smuggling, and the effort to find contraband is not necessarily the way in which a system of criminal procedure will grow up. There are lots of other possible forms in which a system of criminal procedure can take unto itself an image of what the crime is that it is fighting. But so long as that is the image of what crime is being fought, then the fundamental activity of investigation is going somewhere and looking at a thing to find out whether it is contraband or not. And because the thing in its nature isn't contraband, as cocaine or heroin or a bag of marijuana on the driver's seat, on the passenger seat of an automobile, because the thing is in itself a commodity fully acceptable, it's the tax. It's the effort not to pay for it, which requires not just that the thing be found, but that its condition be ascertained, and that records concerning the thing be relevantly accessible. All of that then becomes part of the underlying structure of thought out of which rules about search and seizure emerge. And they are therefore rules about X's contraband in Y's warehouse. And the rules basically say, yeah, well, X's contraband in Y's warehouse is free to find so long as Y's warehouse hasn't been broken into. The place is Y's. The thing is X's. The rights in the place where X's thing is belong to Y. And so long as Y is neither criminally prosecuted nor brutally treated, it is reasonable to expect Y to surrender whatever he knows of X's wrongdoing. And if he doesn't, then he's some kind of accessory or subject to some form of secondary liability himself. If this is the archetypal event, the context out of which claims grow, then it is not unreasonable to expect, and we do in fact arrive at a world in which that sharp distinction concerning places puts the whole subject in a new and much more government-favorable light when the place belongs to X and the contraband, or possible contraband, belongs to Y. At that point, it's easy to say, yeah, well, there's no constitutional problem. We got consent from the guy in the warehouse. We served him with an order. We said, you've got some barrels of X's. We want to find out whether tax was paid on them. That's not your problem. We should not have to do more than offer a warrant to you to search your place, and you should then accept that you can obey to that warrant. And if we don't need physical access, then you should understand that we can use a device that comes from a different piece of law altogether called subpoena, and just send you an order that says, give us the documents. What the hell? As long as our process is fair to you, the question of X's guilt or criminal liability is not your problem, not our problem, and not part of this conversation. So the line between third-party custody and first-party searching is a line which actually sharply divides the constitutional concern from a subject of constitutional non-concern. The security of people in their houses, papers, and effects, including warehouses, is not in question. If all that's happening is Y is being asked, do you by any chance have any evidence of X's wrongdoing on your premises, and can we check? So, the doctrine grows, as I say, with these assumptions lying inside it. The assumptions are themselves the outgrowths of the context in which the law was built, and they become limitations on the extent to which the law can change. Evolution can do remarkable things, and genetic systems are remarkably flexible. But bilateral symmetry never undevelops once it has developed, and the body plan of four legs and five fingers is a body plan which turns out to be quite difficult to modify afterwards. In this very sense, the body plan of the Fourth Amendment rejects grafting onto 21st century conditions. And I have tried, in a way, so far, to explain how that rejection occurs. But I have not completed that explanation, which I wish now to do. Questions at this stage? All right, so then let's ask what it is that happens when the structure, the architecture of the First Amendment meets 20th and then 21st century circumstances. The fundamental question it begins to be posed by the telephone, by the telegraph, if you want to be precise about it, but we have no cases in the Supreme Court on the Fourth Amendment in the telegraph era. Once there is a telephone, we begin to see the effort to search the phone call. And Silverthorne and cases like it from the early part of the 20th century show what must be done to fit the conceptions that are now important inside the paradigm of the Fourth Amendment itself. Where has the breakage occurred? What insecurity has occurred? What form of effort to secure a place as a beachhead to securing evidence, like a telephone booth, say, in Cats Against the United States, what effort has been made to render a place permeable to the needs of the state? What Katz ultimately does, after the wiretapping cases of the 20th century, what Katz ultimately does is to suggest a conceptual structure which might deal well enough with wiretapping, but which ties us back again, as it must, to the founding philosophy of the Fourth Amendment. Who had a legitimate expectation of privacy in a place, in a set of circumstances? A wastebasket in a hotel room, a closed container in the open part of a car, an open container in the closed part of a car, etc., etc. What happens is that the logic applies itself to communications the way it applies itself to physical spaces that aren't houses, like, say, automobiles and hotel rooms. And Katz offers a working philosophical approach which grows organically, or at least the Supreme Court can make it appear to grow organically, out of prior existing law. There are places, there are people who have interests that are legitimate, that it would be unreasonable to disregard. And those people, if they are criminal defendants, may secure suppression of evidence, may call upon the courts to reaffirm their integrity on the grounds that some thugs, maybe in uniform, maybe very good thugs, maybe well-paid union member thugs with badges on and everything, but some thugs did something unreasonable in violating the legitimate expectation of the defendant's privacy, and the courts should therefore refuse to handle the evidence. That's the structure, and Katz can accept a federal statute that takes that structure, and can accept a form of warrant that isn't the usual form of warrant, issued in not quite the usual way, but all of that can be made to fit within a philosophic boundary. That boundary works, at least apparently works, until the degree of social and technological change is large enough that the question has again to be asked, what is a legitimate expectation of privacy? And the answer is, we don't know. This is new stuff. Kilo is an example of how you can deal with that, at least if you're Nino Scalia, in a straightforward, bright-line kind of way. This new stuff, there's a legitimate expectation of privacy that people won't use. Why? Because it's new stuff. And you can carry that only so far. To me, that is, I won't say reeks of, but is redolent of, savors of, the way that Nino Scalia decides a lot of kinds of cases about criminal procedure. He wants a bright line distinction which will reduce the number of cases the United States Supreme Court has to decide. That's an objective. Sometimes admitted, declared, proclaimed, sometimes only implicit, but it's always in his thinking. There are too many cases of this kind as long as the rules are like this. If we make the rules simpler, there will be fewer cases for us to decide. And I am willing to allow an occasional defendant to go free in order to have those simpler rules. The problem with Kilo is it's not exactly clear what the simplicity of the rule is. This octave of the electromagnetic spectrum, rule number one. This octave of the electromagnetic spectrum, rule number two. It's not really quite as clean as he thinks it is, but the idea that it will get rid of a bunch of criminal procedure cases is certainly attractive. And for this purpose, too, the bright line of intrusion, the idea of physical breakage of some perimeter, is also useful. And accounts not just for Jones, but to a whole lot of Jones-like case decisions in which it has been made easy because the cops physically did something in the world. Now, it's clear enough how to describe what happened to defysicalization, to the dematerialization, to the reduction of the importance of space and the increase of the importance of identity. How investigation is conducted. How do police actually do their work? It's, there, as I say, possible to explain that over the course of the 20th century in the United States, police investigation came to hinge on telephone interception to an extraordinary degree. And so the rules about telephone interception and the way that those rules had been domesticated in federal criminal procedure and in the philosophy of the United States Supreme Court covers an awful lot of the practical questions. This mode of criminal investigation, in which we tap a bunch of telephones and we gather a bunch of evidence and then we serve some search warrants and then the prosecutors take over and begin to work it out to present to the grand jury and then to bring to trial, this mode of activity can be rationalized significantly with the help of a couple of doctrinal evolutions that aren't very far from the beginning, and that once you have granted the cat's idea of a legitimate expectation of privacy, it works well enough to allow both an apparently unchanged constitutional order and consistency with the modes of existing criminal investigation. Map Against Ohio changes this to a significant extent because it is no longer the police of the federal government. It's all the police in all the states, everywhere, all the time, subjected to these constitutional rules embedded, as the court finds, in Section 1 of the 14th Amendment. The consequence of which is to make the typical event rather different from the typical event out of which the rules grew. The wiretapping rules grew out of a world in which gambling investigation and interstate trafficking in women for purposes of criminal sexual organization are the major issues left over from the time when the contraband was alcohol and the federal prohibition built the FBI and other federal policing. But not yet the war on drugs, which is, of course, the major dominant concern of the intermediate period, when state police of every kind, local police of every kind, are subject to the constitutional rules. And it's all a great big treasure hunt, looking for drugs, contraband speaking its own forbiddenness when you pick it up. And everything is about whether that could be suppressible evidence. And So there is a kind of halfway modification that occurs after MAP, because the inclusion of all of state and local policing within the domain of the Fourth Amendment, once you add the war on drugs, changes the archetype. It's not smuggling of type X anymore, and it's not, has tax been paid? It's a great hunt for all of the contraband drugs in society, and every argument is about whether the cops validly found it or not. The other major piece that is modified through changes in the expectation of basic criminal procedure has to do with the nullification of the Fourth Amendment at low level on the street. That's the practical content of what we call Terry against Ohio, right? The one thing that happens in the course of the later 20th century that arises out of alteration of criminal procedure, and which can only arrive once you have applied the Fourth Amendment to all the state and local police, is what happens on the street. What happens on the street was not an important question for the Fourth Amendment before MAP, because it wasn't applicable to the behavior of the LAPD. What happens on the street is important in the world of Terry against Ohio for all the usual American reasons, including the electric element, which is the color line in American life. The cop and the citizen. But what Terry against Ohio does is to suggest that at that moment, on the street, in the close proximity, where the rubber meets the road, the Fourth Amendment sustains a radical quantum breakdown. You're too close now. At that place, at that small, you could say, internuclear diameter, the Fourth Amendment doesn't function. Why? Because the safety of the policeman. Because the physical juxtaposition of the policeman and the suspect is a dangerous place within which the idea that you should have to get a warrant and that everything has to be formalized and that the rule of law really isn't going to happen. Terry's understanding that on the street, in the real world of the endangered policeman, reasonable suspicion, articulable suspicion, just a way of giving a reason is sufficient to justify, well, a search, a pretty thorough one, for the purpose of ensuring the police's safety, but ultimately resulting, again and again, in admissible evidence. And the Terry stop becomes another outcome of the way that MAP changes the Fourth Amendment by applying it more broadly. Once it applies to all police everywhere, then it applies on the street, unless we find a way of saying, well, no, the United States Constitution requires more than the distance between two protons before it comes into existence. At that moment where police and the citizens, unlucky, unfortunate, the citizens may be, there really isn't any Fourth Amendment left. Probable cause is not the aspect of the thing. Particularity in what is taken isn't the thing. Whether it was in the pocket or it was in the hand or it was dropped on the street doesn't really matter. All of that goes away within the very narrow confines of the physical confrontation between the police and the citizen. It is, of course, perfectly reasonable to ask, well, then what, right? If the diameter, if proximity is sufficient to nullify the Constitution, then when is there going to be any Constitution left? And this you can see working its way out ultimately in Riley. If Riley is a coherent case at all, that's what it's coherent of. The court doesn't really want to say that, you know, it's about cell phones. The Chief Justice needs to inform us that cell phones have a lot of memory these days. But it's not really about memory either, in the sense that what it's about is whether that weird short-distance nullification of the Fourth Amendment, which is, after all, as much about control of undesirable persons as it is anything else, not really a rule accumulating on the history and philosophy of the Fourth Amendment, but a rule of necessity to protect the immunity of the policeman, whether that rule is ultimately indeed going to open a hole so broad that the carrying of the mobile phone with all that memory in it becomes the thing that search incident to arrest is always about. And this is a reminder that in the 21st century, the policing function in our society has come to be about the forensic investigation of mobile phones in the way it used to be about telephone taps. All police investigation, to a first approximation, begins with seizing phones and looking at them. A former student of mine in my practice, not at Columbia Law School, who built a nice criminal defense practice in New York City after he left law school, realized almost 10 years ago now that if he and his brother wanted an investment opportunity, they should buy forensic equipment for searching cell phones and set up a forensic cell phone searching agency, because they could get police contracts up the wazoo and do some work for defense counsel analyzing the phones previously analyzed by police. This was in on the ground floor of how policing is really organized. Riley, of course, doesn't change that. Riley is just as much about normalizing police behavior as the Terry stop. It doesn't actually say that we're not going to build our criminal investigation practices in the United States on forensic analysis of seized phones. It just says that we're not going to allow you to do warrantless searches of phones on the basis of Terry stop-like nullification of the Fourth Amendment, because it's not really about the safety of the officer, or even evidence destruction, although that's the best hook left. So these fundamental, these substantive changes in the way policing is done change the requirements of the Fourth Amendment in some narrow fashions. But as I tried to suggest last time, those are the least of it. What really happens that shows the weakness of the Fourth Amendment under 21st century conditions are two broader pieces of the technological environment. The first is the replacement of searching of places by searching of identities. The object of the effort ceases to be to find a place with something in it, to retrieve those things, to provide probable cause for arrest, and to arrest the suspect. Instead, what has come to happen as policing moves more and more to the nuts and bolts of everything is just, we seize a phone and we look inside it, what is fundamentally happening is that the locus of search is becoming identity. A person is of interest. A suspect, a witness, a person is of interest, and we begin searching the identity of that person. Which is quite different from the houses, papers, and effects, right? Not the physical being, but all the social relationships of the person. And we pursue the interrogation of identity in part by physical seizures of boxes on the street, but for all practical purposes, that's the least of it. We serve the needs of investigation by subpoenaing people who hold information. Consider, if you will, what all the various skullduggers and scam artists and renegade law professors and so on who helped Donald Trump try to steal the presidential election, consider what it is that they are facing by mode of interrogation at the moment. They're all uptight and they're suing and carrying on just as the culprits always do, but what they are objecting to is that Verizon was asked for their telephone records. What they're objecting to is the style of investigation now commonplace in every relationship of potentially criminal liability in the society, in which the real question is what third parties are going to disgorge what information to complete a search of identity, to attribute actions and intentions to persons based on information available elsewhere. This is the primary. It was the primary point of failure, or at least the most important gap in the form of relationship between constitutional law and investigation in the 18th century. The third party, the warehouseman, the person with the barrels, is easy to serve a warrant on and has neither a reason nor a claim to assert the rights of anybody else. Once the principal activity of policing is identity searching, and the information necessary to disclose and attribute every action of a human being lies in third-party hands, the real problem is that, well, the amendment crosses on the other side of the street. It doesn't mean to. It's not like the spook cop distinction and something baked into the bones. It's simply that the way policing has done has moved far enough from the searching of places to the interrogation of identity that the people have the wrong security. The amendment offers security of the wrong thing. And here, and this is the other part of my point last week, regrettably, the people owe it to themselves. They did this. Because it wasn't merely the growth of the law in this direction, the movement to the searching of identities and the movement to giving primacy to third parties, it was a change in social life. And the change was that people decided to entrust third parties with all that information regardless of the harm done to their rights. So that not only did the theory of policing change, But at least implicitly, the theory of how to be a free person in society changed. And it became consistent with people's understanding of themselves as free people, citizens in a society operated by the rule of law, to tempt that supposed reality by depositing everything with third parties and seeing what happens. The answer is, if you deposit everything with third parties and see what happens is you lose your rights. It's not a complicated conclusion. It's not a complicated prediction. It's not hard to see the reality around us. It's not hard to read in the cases everything that they don't talk about and everything that they pretend doesn't matter. We can see it clearly enough. But the change in people's attitudes about what their freedoms are and what they're entitled to do with them has resulted in their massive increase in their vulnerability to precisely the kind of thuggery which not only in the United States but elsewhere in the world digital technology was reducing costs in, such that everybody can afford the kind of thuggery that only the richest and most single-minded thugs could ever previously have afforded. And they do so in an economy which is dominated by, well, what we ought, I think, to call privacy invasion subcontractors. That's, of course, the financial intermediaries and so on, but mostly, well, you know what it is, because it operates the spy satellite in your pocket. The privacy invasion contractors are the working organizations of Shoshana Zuboff's surveillance capitalism. Their job is spying on the people and bilking them, and they've grown very rich doing it. And in the process, they have created what has been called convenience. But they have also created a machine for the deterioration of fundamental rights. And the beauty of that machine deteriorating fundamental rights is it has no constitutional limitations because it isn't the government. Before MAP, the greatest loophole in the thing was the form of the silver platter exception that said, well, if state detectives go, or police in the locality go and do unreasonable searching, the evidence is still admissible in federal court because no federal officer violated anybody's rights. They received the evidence on a silver platter. MAP is supposed to have changed that, and indeed it did. The silver platter is not now held by the state of California. The silver platter is now held by KGB of Mountain View. And from them, you can get anything you want. Just ask them. And if they fight you, it's a sham fight. Because after all, in the long run, their interest is in spying on everybody and bilking them. They want to make money. All they want is not to lose money by allowing you to see some of what they spied on. And here comes the tension that I described in the third Snowden lecture between the Googles of the world who think, yeah, well, we made a deal fair and square with you. We will let you spy on people this way, but we won't let you spy on people that way, and who then are very disappointed to discover that the spies didn't keep their word, and they were spying on everything in their own way. And then federal law comes along, and under the pressure or the opportunity presented by the events of September 2001, the federal government comes along and says, oh, by the way, anything the spies collect, we can use. And we have subpoenaing of all the other spies. And therefore, we don't really care about your Fourth Amendment. We don't have to anymore. In 2001, early, before those events happened, when the question before us in our lives was still the presidential election of 2000 and its odd outcome, I was having a conversation, allegedly out of bounds, off time, not on the clock, with a senior FBI official. And I was giving him a hard time about how many people the Bureau was then employing spying on us, one way and another. And I said to him, you know, if you had had half as many agents in Florida checking on electoral integrity as you have had spying on my clients, then the presidential election would come out the other way, and we would all not be suffering under the reign of George W. Bush, which you don't like any more than I do. And the FBI guy says, give me a break. I don't have any a power to do any kind of thuggery in your world. I really don't. He said, you should meet the guys who work for me. They all used to work at AOL, and they have ponytails. That was very important to him. They have ponytails. And therefore, they are the sort of people who would just love for me to make a mistake because they would turn me in a heartbeat. And they would love if I got fried for something I ordered them to do which wasn't okay. So stop worrying about them. It's Citibank you should worry about. And I felt that that had been a really productive engagement because I was right and he was right and some useful things had been said both sides, although I didn't expect him to acknowledge it. It was, of course, true. Citibank was more of a problem than the Bureau was. Because the Bureau was full of people who wanted to resist the Bureau, but Citibank didn't want to resist the Bureau. It just didn't want to spend any money unnecessarily. And it had the stuff. And no policeman worth his salt would go out and try and whack up the stuff by getting it in the field when they could send a note over to Citibank and have a conversation lawyer to lawyer about it. So what happened? The nature of the society changed in three important ways. The breadth of the amendment's application to local policing required Terry. In other words, there was a constitutional escape valve to allow the necessary thuggery in society, which is on the street, addressed to those people. And the form of criminal investigation that's most important in making cases changed because the mobile phone. And the third-party doctrines, which are really exceptions from all doctrines, became crucially important because the privacy invasion subcontractors did their work and stuff that cops and secret police would want to know about billions of people sat in their hands and gave them an opportunity to decide with what leverage they would play it. And then events contingently arose, and the spook cop distinction, which was unique in American law and which constrained the world's best intelligence services from acting on behalf of the police of the United States, disappeared. Or at least the restrictions became so malleable that there were lots of ways that any prosecutor, state or federal, who really wanted and had political clout behind could use them. And the Fourth Amendment tragically fails to keep up, which really means is about a world that doesn't exist anymore, mostly. And so it remains as a monument of what we could have. And I did want to say last time, and this is why we can't have nice things. Because you convenienced them away. Now, I'm not actually arguing that that is the reason why we can't have nice things. There are several reasons why we can't have nice things. But if nice things means the form of rule of law applying to surveillance and seizure, then I do want to submit that we can have them only if we're willing to act for them. They will not be given to us. Just won't. Now, all of this is a very American argument, of course. I am busily explaining how a particular thing occurred in the United States in particular ways, and it would be good to get beyond that and to take a slightly more general view. But of course, once one does, it doesn't get happier. The fundamental relationship between the state and the privacy invasion subcontract is uniform. The power of the privacy invasion subcontractors is overwhelming. What they possess is of overwhelming value. Everybody keeps moving in the direction of affording them more and more power, even if they claim not to be doing so. And the cashless society is the greatest single transfer of power to them that it is possible to make, and one society after another is rapidly making them. The relationship between the secret police and the police, the more we get outside the domain of the United States, is a relationship of identity, not distinction. No major Western European government, no Chinese government of any kind, anywhere, no government outside our own has ever even purported to want to maintain the strong distinction between the spook and the cop. That was our strangeness. Nobody else now purports to be engaged in undertaking it. You can look at an enormous slew of so-called European privacy legislation, and you will never find a limitation on the secret world because it's not there. On the contrary, post-Snowden, the empowerment of everybody's secret worlds by legislation was the order of the day. And whether it's the Investigatory Powers Act in the UK, or it's the French Military Platforms Bill, or it's our Patriot Act plus other secret presidential findings, and we needn't talk about Tsar Vladimir or Xi Jinping, I mean, the attitude has been uniformly everywhere that we should empower our listeners to do more, and we should tighten their relationship to policing and to thuggery, because this produces tranquility, social stability, fights terrorism, whatever it is. But with an existential tone, if we don't do this, we are in peril. You could conceive a uniform way of describing what should happen from my point of view, or maybe even your point of view. I can't be sure, of course. But you can give a uniform rule, which is the one that I offered in the Sneck and Snowden lectures. Every society has two obligations in these circumstances. One is to protect its citizens and inhabitants from spying outside. Every state has a responsibility to produce the kind of security that the Fourth Amendment presents as the goal, and it has that responsibility to do so with respect to outsiders. No society should allow its citizens' sanctity of life to be corrosively invaded by the listening and the spying of outsiders. And every state should protect its citizens by subjecting its own domestic spying and listening to the rule of law. You can say that those are the two large-scale general requirements, and that the United States' failure in the Fourth Amendment context is merely one among a series of failures of the states of the world to observe those simple rules. Government should protect citizens from spying outside, and it should subject its own domestic order-keeping or intelligence-gathering spying to the rule of law. But that, of course, is counsel of idealism, perfection, never going to be achieved. There is no day on which that's going to be the outcome of the English Parliament or the French National Assembly or the relation between FSB and the Russian state, Ministry of State Security and the Chinese Communist Party. To state the necessary relationship simply is also to recognize that they will never occur. It's outside the politics of the present. And the reason it's outside the politics of the present, aside from the reluctance of states to reduce their own power and to treat their citizens more decently, the reason it's out, well, because nobody has demanded it, because you all rolled over. Once again, it's unfortunate to have to point it that way. But obviously there is no political case for what ought to be done if the people will not force it. And nobody will. All over the world, whether we are talking about intermediary civil liabilities or responsibilities to provide evidence in criminal cases, or simply the responsibility to integrate digital currencies with state systems of control and taxation. Wherever we inspect the political structures of the present, and with Mishy, I write about this all the time in India, and we write about it in Europe, and every time government and the privacy invasion subcontractors fight with one another, two outcomes can be predicted. One, the terrain given up will be that of neither party, but of the people themselves. All compromises are at the expense of the users, so-called. And the states win. Because at the end of the day, the privacy invasion subcontractors want to make money. They don't want to have wars with states. They protect their corner to the extent that the politics between them and the relevant government allows them some bargaining leverage. And they bargain away our heart's blood rather than their own. But whatever they bargain away, in the end, the state gets peace on its terms. And the privacy invasion subcontractors and the state have once again partitioned the land of the free to be a little less free, and they go and have lunch, and we live with it. And that process is not merely limited to the constitutional discussion in the United States. On the contrary, that process occurs everywhere with less constitutional discussion. But always, and at the end of the day, with the recognition that whatever is said about the data markets, the states get to do what they want. This is the outcome of the movement of data protection legislation through the Indian Parliament at the moment, where suddenly at the last minute, the state is exempted from all responsibilities under the data protection law unless it chooses to have them. This is the outcome as the criminal law reform moves from the House of Commons to the House of Lords in England this year, where mysteriously more pieces favorable to the settlement that Her Majesty's government would like with the big tech companies arises. You will have noticed that Mr. Zuckerberg has put another layer of lip gloss on the former Deputy Prime Minister of the United Kingdom and sent him out as worldwide President of Government Relations today. Nick Clegg's promotion within Facebook is actually the job of being the chief bargainer now with governments, while Mr. Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg are under a cloud and their ability to negotiate aggressively with governments is low. So send out the maitre d' to talk to the customers who are fractions. And that, modulo the ways in which Microsoft Music or Google Music are different from Facebook Music, is the music. It's how it inevitably works. Questions or comments to this point? Yeah?
From what I understand, you said that recently we moved into trusting third parties with personal information, and that led to the third parties giving up our information. But I thought this wasn't exactly a new phenomenon. Like, it did increase in scope in the 21st century, in the late 20th century.
Yes, that's, we're in agreement about that, and I am simply saying a Marxist thing, namely that at some point quantitative changes become qualitative changes. And all I've done is to argue in that sense, as you are saying, that the accumulation of those alterations actually tipped the balance of power in new and important ways. And when we clear whatever the questions now are, then I want to go back to your original proposition of 2 weeks ago, that why don't I explain what we can technically do about it, because of course I do intend to. But let's finish where you were going, because so far we're in good agreement and we should figure out what comes next.
I just wanted to say that right now, if we talk about personal information that we have, when we have emails and such, we have, well, relatively good encryption methods that we can protect, so surveillance, or so, you know, companies or the government wants us to believe. But even when there were telegraphs, people probably didn't expect to code their every letter that they sent abroad, but
yeah,
government still copied every single message.
But you're looking in the wrong place for the change, because you're concentrating on the writing. And this, again, as at several other junctures in this course, is a place where I need to issue a warning that as long as you're concentrating on the writing, you're not seeing the problem. Nobody ever had the kind of ability to surveil your reading, ever, which is currently in everybody's hand. Nobody had the ability to follow everybody at once and to collect everybody's locations, ever. No government ever possessed a robust social graph of its terrain. Not even the Securitate in Romania or Stasi in the German Democratic Republic. Nobody ever had the kind of ability to enter into people's ordinary lives, what they read, what they think, what they search for, what they say. Nobody. No team of informants, no matter how high as a proportion of population, could ever achieve that. As long as you're looking primarily at the acts of communication by the individual, you lose all that, which is not merely context, it's the whole ballgame. You're right, of course, that the moment at which it became possible for the best team in the world to acquire all wireless communications and a bunch of the wired communications lies in the middle of the 20th century. It is the Americans after the Second World War who first begin to explore that range, as they are, was said after Trinity, the now the God of death. I am death, the destroyer of worlds. At the same moment that Oppenheimer was saying that about the United States because of the invention of nuclear weapons, we were also beginning the process of becoming the signals intelligence hierarchy that we became, the possessor of all the telecommunications, all the commercial cables, all the banking information, etc., etc. And you're right, therefore, that this isn't the new party. But that's not what you gave away. That's not what you gave away. You gave away the ability to read without being surveilled. You have preferentially decided to use only media of reading which spy on your reading. You have preferentially decided to reveal your whereabouts at all times to power. What really happened was that power fought a war on anonymity and you went to its side. And that grows out of the culture of encryption, there's no doubt, but it does in a surprising way. A little earlier than this moment of the year, in January of 1995, so we are now quite a while ago, in the Pleistocene, I suppose. In January of 1995, there was a debate at Harvard Law School on the subject of public key encryption and government interference, the Clifford chip, etc. The two parties speaking for freedom were me, And my comrade Danny Weitzner, leader of the social domain of the W3C, founder of the CDT, etc., etc. On the other side from us was the then Deputy Attorney General of the United States, Jamie Gorelick, who liked to refer to herself put Janet Reno in her place as the Justice Department's chief operating officer, and Stuart Baker, formerly the general counsel of the National Security Agency, our listeners, then already beginning his long and distinguished career in private practice as the man you gotta see if you want to do stuff that NSA might object to. So the two of us, two on a side, were debating the question of whether the federal government should control encryption its purchasing power by buying Clifford chip phones or in some other way, and all the usual stuff got hashed out for 2 years, the then usual stuff, and we broke for dinner and started walking across the Harvard campus to the Harvard Faculty Club for dinner. As we were walking across Harvard Yard, Jamie Gorelick says to me, she says, "You know, Edmund, based only on your public statements this afternoon, I have enough to authorize interception of your telephone calls." This was a joke. Okay? I thought it was a joke in bad taste from the Deputy Attorney General of the United States to a citizen. But it was a joke. Everybody knew she couldn't do it. It was a joke. We all laughed. And then we got to the faculty club and we ate this stupid dinner and the, you know, everything went very slowly and eventually the port and the walnuts were put down and the tablecloth was carried away. And Stewart turns to me and he says, you know, he says, we're not going to prosecute your client, Mr. Zimmerman. That was a little weird because he wasn't in government, but he was speaking on behalf of we will not pro- my client was Philip Zimmerman, the inventor of PGP, and we were in the height of one portion of the struggle over that. This was Stewart's announcement of a surrender, sort of. You know, he says, and we're not going to prosecute your client, Mr. Zimmerman. We've been conducting a holding action against strong public key encryption in civil society for almost 20 years now. And we've done pretty well, but we recognize that it can't go on forever, as we always did. And then he looked around the table, and he said, but nobody here cares about anonymity. And that moment struck a chill in my spine, really. The physiological response, the cold running up the spine. I don't have that much, but I had it at that moment. And I thought, aha, okay. That's how it's going to be, Stewart. You're going to spend 20 years trying to eliminate anonymity in human society, and I'm going to try and stop. I didn't even tell that story until 2012. And then I was giving a talk in the Washington inner ring in Bethesda, as it happens, to a bunch of people, all of whom followed this beat, and who had one or another role in policy making or criticism. And Stewart was in the audience, and I told the story. And I said, so you see how these intervening 17 years have gone. I said, Stewart has done way better than even I feared. And I have done less well than even he hoped. But it's not over yet. And that was 10 years ago, and now it's mostly over. The goal of eliminating anonymity was the goal of the national security establishment in the United States because of another outgrowth of that Cold War moment. It grew out of the theory of deterrence by mutually assured destruction. The United States Empire, after Vietnam, became a place in which the idea was we could deter it if we knew who did it, whatever it is. If we have complete attribution, if we have the ability to attach everything done to whoever did it, then we can deter anything because we have enough force. And even in asymmetric contact, which was the problem of the national security planners of the 1990s, we're going to fight asymmetric wars in future, terrorists and guerrillas and such. Even in that world, if we have complete ability to attribute, we can deter. And that theory lies under everybody's internet policy in the 21st century now. When George W. Bush's national security advisor, Admiral John Poindexter, said there should be total information awareness, he was out on that. He was ahead of his skis a little bit. The Senate threw him out of town, but they never really prevented the theory. And of course, if we want to understand what Xizhong is, it's a place for the attribution of every action by a deterrable person. It's this, the desire of the states for perfect attribution and the desire of the people for convenience, which comes into conflict. And from that conflict is born whatever the fate of freedom is. And if you ask our friends in Beijing, they know the answer. If you ask me, I know the desired answer. And if you ask Washington, it remains very unsure because it wants everything. It can't have everything. And although it is a democracy, it does not want the people to decide, which is what Mr. Snowden said. He was right. But if you concentrate your attention on whether you and I can encrypt our email, we are getting the wrong piece of it. What we ought to be asking is, how successful are we at freeing you from the widespread and comprehensive surveillance of your learning? And the answer is, we're no place. Even my best efforts are being constantly reversed by people who think that a classroom should be a perfectly surveilled place. And they are able to maintain that idea because students think it's convenient for recordings to exist. And whatever my pedagogical approach might be to that question, and I do have one, the real problem isn't whether that's good pedagogy or not. The real problem is, are we going to agree that every classroom is allowed to have ears and everything said by students is going to be remembered forever by people in power? And if somebody brings a sexual harassment complaint at Harvard University, Harvard is going to go and get the therapist's records and submit them in the process, and this will be seen as okay because, after all, everything is being surveyed. But it isn't. And if everything is being surveilled, that's not because Google decided it, it's because you decided it. Did you want to follow up, Mark? Okay, so.
I just had a question regarding the idea of WISE warehouses, third-party warehouses, because a few days ago I came across this slightly troubling news where police in San Francisco had used DNA from a rape kit to identify a suspect and then they charged her. And I'm just wondering, would this basically circumvent the Fourth Amendment because of the idea that you were already in the police's custody or the idea of WISE warehouse?
How did they come by the DNA, Sam?
It was in a rape kit, so she basically reported a sexual assault, and then as part of that, she had a rape kit was done on her, and then later on, what the police did was to use that DNA, the victim's DNA in the rape kit, to then trace it to that lady and then charge her for property crimes.
Okay, and so let us begin by asking, what would happen in the United States if the police said to every person who wishes to report a sexual assault, give us your mobile phone first so that we can search it, so that we can find out what contact you may have had with the person against you, whom you're complaining, etc., etc. Let's leave the DNA cooling in the automobile for a moment and ask about the mobile phone. What would happen if police, in effect, made it a condition of even thinking about prosecuting that the complaining witness turn over her life in her mobile phone? That would be right. Of course, that's correct. That will certainly happen. What will happen when the argument is made that the police should not be allowed to do that? What if I say, but the Fourth Amendment, Your Honor? Or I bring an action for damages on behalf of all the people who were so treated by the police? I'm asking this question because, of course, this is currently a good comparative law subject, since that's been going on in England now for more than 5 years, and the result has been, as the campaigners would say, the effective decriminalization of rape. First, because, as you say, a bunch of complainants are deterred, and then because a bunch of complainants are not deterred and are willing to surrender their entire lives, but police and prosecutors then discover evidence that makes them not want to bring the cases because they hate bringing cases which are complicated. And once they've surveilled the complaining witness's private activity since whenever it was that the phone was first put in service, they begin to find reasons not to prosecute, and suddenly there are no prosecutions going on. Now, you see why I think that the question of practices of investigation is as important as all other constitutional material combined. There will come a time later in the 21st century when the collection of genetic material and its instantaneous analysis by single chip devices will make that a very important part of police investigation, where now it isn't. Some portion of that will be subject to technical criticism by Innocence Project-like, Baryshek-like lawyers who have strong skills in the criticism of the behavior. And somewhere along the way, there will be some question about what the constitutional limits are. And the federal constitution will not be the primary provider of limits. The ultimate question will be what found material were they entitled to admit? Had they legitimate access to the car? Yeah, it was towed to the pound, Your Honor. Does that mean that they had a right to search the car once it arrived at the pound? Yes, as a matter of fact, they did, Your Honor. In fact, the tow pound and the junkyard are particularly favorable places for the cops, Your Honor, because you yourselves in the Supreme Court have held that those are regulated activities, and suppressing chop shops and car theft rings justifies allowing warrantless searches of junkyards, which the United States Supreme Court said in a pair of cases in 1987, Illinois against Kroll and New York against Hoffman, which I had a little to do with. So what will ultimately come out of the line of thinking that you're following will be more room and less constitutional reliability, I predict. I'm offering a prediction on the basis of some reasoning. But also it will help us to concentrate our attention on what it is that the Fourth Amendment doesn't really do. Which again has to do with the perfectly legitimate desire of courts to allow policing to occur. Courts do not wish to disable policing. But what policing they are either enabling or disabling isn't chosen by the judges. It's chosen by the cops. It's chosen by in San Francisco, it would be said to be a police facing large public order difficulties and looking for every possible way to increase public order without increasing the police they don't have or the risks of bad interactions with citizens. It's precisely the reason that Eric Adams was suggesting last week that the New York PD should step up its use of facial recognition technology across the entirety of its activity. You want to produce public safety? You want to produce public safety chiefly? You want to back up the police in a tough time, et cetera, et cetera? Give them those tools. And the courts will ultimately discover that if this is the reigning paradigm of police activity, it can be made acceptable under the Fourth Amendment for any one of a number of possible reasons, and you stated one. Does that help?
Kind of.
And where could I be more helpful without being more optimistic? Because I have no optimism to offer. I don't know that I think that our tools depend upon foreknowledge. When in the face of a public employee strike, the city of San Francisco, as long as we're talking about it, we'll just keep talking about it. When in the face of a public employee strike, the city of San Francisco and BART agreed to shut down Wi-Fi in a series of stations around San Francisco in order to make it harder for demonstrations to occur, the courts did not interfere. But they would have after a time if the police had not backed off from that commuter maddening way of trying to control public demonstrations. If Carrie Lam does it in Hong Kong tomorrow, it will be regarded as nothing whatever, where 3 or 4 years ago would have been a major subject of dispute. And Indian policing, talk about this, right? So of course, part of it has to do with the way in which it is the purpose of the court system to legitimize, not to prevent. My dear late friend Charles Black wrote an entire book, The People in the Court, in 1964, the purpose of which was to show that judicial review in America is not primarily for the purpose of striking down legislation. The purpose of judicial review is primarily to legitimize legislation by agreeing to its constitutionality. And it's hard to imagine any system of civil liberties protecting constitutional guarantees against government that won't wind up like that more than you would think. Because the real impulse is to decide what's reasonable. And it's hard to wake up one morning and go to work deciding that what has always been is no longer reasonable. The middle 20th century did that in constitutional law. It did that in Brown against the Board of Education. It did that in a series of criminal procedure decisions that we call the Warren Court Revolution. But it's at any given moment a mere periodicity in the larger amplitude of the relationship between the courts and the cops. And once you allow the spooks into that dialogue, then the legitimation becomes ever more important, and the reasons given become ever more existential and more urgent, and the results, they get murkier. But let's begin by saying that it is within the people's power to convert what is weak in these principles into what is strong. By framing. Well, by technological framing. The question isn't whether you're encrypting your email. The question is, where are you storing your data? The minute that data is on a hard drive in a house, your house, everything changes. The gradients of every form of logic turned upside down. It's not complicated. It just works. So, therefore, not quite 15 years ago, no, more than 15, but not quite 16, I went to give a talk on this subject, and I used the annual conference of MySQL and its developers as the place to have my talk on this subject. MySQL was then a bigger proportion of all the free software databases in the world than it is now, and it wasn't owned by Oracle. It was its own Nordic free software company, and at their annual convention of all places, of course, Mountain View, California, in 2006, I went to give a talk. The talk was entitled, Why Free Beer is Not So Good If Your Data is Getting Drunk, which was an inside joke about free beer as opposed to free software. But the purpose of the talk was to say, store it yourself. It was therefore appropriate for a free software database convention because it was about store it yourself. But the real purpose was to discuss memory and the control of memory. Because I was merely the intellectual entertainment at a business conference, I was allowed to talk about the history of Niemannism and the inventions of memory technology in the European world and how we thought about memory since the 16th century. And what it's all very nice and decorative, but the real point was to say that remembering it yourself is what we were devoted to always. And in the world we're about to live in, you should put your data on a hard drive under the bed because that's where the Fourth Amendment protects it most. And indeed, that's if you wanted a single prescription, that's the one. Right? Imagine that all that data that is out there to be subpoenaed and lies at the whim of X and Y and Z and T and W is instead within the curtilage of your dwelling. Now all of a sudden all the various ifs, ands, and buts move in the opposite direction because it's the home you're on. Where was the warrant? Because even in hot pursuit, even with a crime in sight, as we learned in Whitehall and Rhode Island, you can't just rush into the house. And as for what you take from it, you better have a warrant and it better say and blah, blah, blah. And although seizure of computer equipment has gotten very ungoverned in the United States and taking everything is the mode once the search warrant has been served, still, that's a much heavier lift than can we send a note to Google asking them for everything you've said in the last 6 months and everything you've read and everywhere you've been and all the rest of it. I'm not terribly concerned about my email compared to many people, I take good technological effort to keep it from being easy just to stroll in and take. And even the best teams of the world are going to have to do retail level effort in order to get to that email. But what I'm really trying to do is to make sure that nobody knows where I've been. Nobody knows what music I've been listening to. Nobody knows what calls I took or made. All of which it is perfectly possible for me to be sure lies on a spindle that sits in my home. And if you want to look at it, get a warrant and tell them you're searching my home and that a lawyer lives there and that the records of his law practice are there because all the server power in my law practice also sits inside my home. So get a warrant. Don't think that any third party's going to roll over and hand it to you because there aren't any. At that point, the calculus is different. We don't know exactly how. We can't be sure. If the U.S. attorney wants to prosecute me for something, they'll get a warrant. But they'll need to talk to people in Washington because serving that warrant on a law practice is going to require more. And they're going to have to make a showing. And that showing will not just consist of some FBI agents with their fingers crossed behind their backs saying, well, we think he's guilty of sin, Jack. And what happens after that will raise questions that aren't squirrely questions. They're exactly the kinds of questions that the United States Supreme Court feels most competent to deal with, like Jones and Riley. What did they break, and how did they get in, and what did they, and I'm going to make it difficult at every one of those steps. Then, of course, there are some technical difficulties. They're going to have to bring a lot of liquid nitrogen. Because they've got a cold boot, every single one of those computers. If the power is removed for an instant, all the storage is hard encrypted, and good luck to them. Now, to one of my comrades, once upon a time, the U.S. intelligence services cold booted a laptop in a Prague hotel room. It's not that the spooks don't know, and they could bring a tank of liquid nitrogen with them. But in my apartment, there's a lot of stuff they have to freeze. And if they forget any one of those pieces, the rest of the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle might not fit together. And that's not illegitimate or indicative of criminal intent on my part. I take cybersecurity seriously. You should have brought more liquid nitrogen. Maybe you should have just pumped it into the entire apartment. Froze everything down to the bananas. At every step along the way, the fact that that's a home, the fact that the requirements are at their maximum in that home, the fact that the margin for error, constitutionally speaking, in that home is not great, the fact that therefore the cost of performing the search has to be, from the point of view of the police, well worth all the cost involved in it, changes things. It changes things not because the Fourth Amendment wasn't written in the 18th century anymore, or because it's not about identity searching. It's because I reduced the attack surface to my house, thank you very much. And by reducing the attack surface, I changed the attacker's possible behavior, and I altered the attacker's costs. Now, of course, if it's the Chinese Ministry of State Security, they don't serve a warrant. They just break in. Which means that on the other side, constitutional law can be of little effect because the United States government does nothing whatever to prevent me from suffering Chinese government searching. Not so big a problem for me in person in particular, but a big problem overall. It's hard to understand how the United States government can complain about the extraordinary behavior of the Chinese government in the net autocratically everywhere without actually attempting to protect Americans against their behavior, but that was never the government. As I say, the agreement with the Chinese government that exfiltration is unlimitable and that no limits should be applied goes as far back as the beginning of last decade. So now we're back again to the question about self-help. And to see self-help as somehow an alternative to constitutional government is probably, and this is my this is my reserved concern, it's probably wrong. Self-help isn't the thing that comes after government promises. Self-help is the basis of government promises. Self-help is why government promises civil liberty at all. Because if it doesn't have it, it faces, well, conflict. And the question becomes, how necessary is that conflict? If your sweaty fingers are barely holding the mandate of heaven in your hand, then maybe everything is an existential problem, and you should be prepared to break every zone of privacy in order to maintain it. That's the current view of the Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party, to the extent that I can interpret or understand it. The American government is never so clear. It's always consisting of multiple voices and multiple attitudes. And I suppose you could say that the United States Supreme Court is still an important decision maker. If Sonia Sotomayor came to work one day and there were four other votes for some opinion holding third-party custodians within the reach of some Fourth Amendment right of those whose goods they have in keeping, she could do it, but she needs four more votes and she won't have them. And so probably the court is not a major source of decision making. And you are. But it wouldn't be convenient. Isn't that right? It's because it wouldn't be convenient that you're not doing it, right? I mean, there's no other reason. It's not that you don't want to have stronger constitutions. They said people have convinced you that if you were storing your own calendar, the world would fall apart. And that's obviously not true. So we choose the level of constitutional protection that we want. And that turns out to be the way constitutional restrictions exist in democracies, because the people want them and they make it clear that they will have them. But it won't get you five votes on the Supreme Court. Cheap hard drives? We got plenty. It would be better to look over there. Comments or questions? Yeah. Less here than all over the world, in fact, because the United States government and its political subdivisions never settled on a way of using smartphone monitoring for contact tracing. So, in fact, it turned out that American localism and the fractiousness of American local politics was an enormous protection against that outcome, compared whether to the UK or to Singapore or to Hong Kong, or let alone zero-COVID behavior of the Chinese, the Americans actually turned out to do comparatively little surveillance for public health purposes. And to the extent that they did, the privacy invasion subcontractors were not much enabled, because they were blocked by one particular column of the American fabric, namely HIPAA, and the particular treatment of health information. And so between the desire of the privacy invasion subcontractors, Apple and Google did a far better job of making contact tracing and public health surveillance software responsible about its uses of data than the governments would do alone. And Apple and Google's requirement that in each country there be only one public surveillance application using their platform, so the governments were compelled to establish monopolies, again functioned in the direction of protecting Americans, because it was perfectly apparent that no way that an American federal system could result in one iOS and one Android application for all public health monitoring. So, at the cost of 800,000 deaths, which is not a small cost, we wound up with an unusually libertarian outcome with respect to COVID surveillance in the United States. And although all through this time, this is the third time I've been offered this course during the epidemic, each time we spend time analyzing and speculating, and students write essays and I edit them and we think about it together, on the question of what kinds of surveillance left behinds will there be when the epidemic is over, the American situation oddly will clear the table more completely than it will ever be cleared in Russia or in Singapore. So I don't know exactly how to think about that question, the one that you're analogizing, to the one that I think you wanted to talk about and started with, which is where the mayor is at the moment. Do you want to go back to the mayor, or are we done?
Well, no, I was really foreshadowing the point that if you can't trust the government with your information and other senses, then what extent should anyone feel comfortable trusting your health information?
Okay, so now we are in another place, from my point of view, to which the epidemic is significant but not dispositive, which is what happens once the processes of so-called big data are the foundation of healthcare. And that's an important subject. We are moving to a world in which human bodies in the United States are colonized by insurance companies. That's the basic structure that we have allegedly voted for. And it will tighten. It's maintained by a series of anti-free software structures, the proprietary health record, the most important of them. It's maintained by a series of anti-socialist ideas about how healthcare should be delivered. But it primarily functions the way all capitalist extractive enterprises have functioned since the late 15th century. It uses greed to destroy what my co-authors, Marx and Engels, once upon a time called all chartered liberties, right? It subjects everything to the cash nexus.
Another person who was born on the same circle of the sun by our bus that I was in, Dev Estrin, was the person among all of us who first grasped the idea of the trillion sensor world. Deb was on vacation with her young family in Costa Rica in 1979 and had some form of visionary insight standing in the rainforest in Costa Rica, and she said to herself, what if the rainforest had sensors all over and it could know itself? Two things happened from 1979 to now. Deb spent her career as a computer scientist in making the trillion sensor universe the object of her study, and it turned out that the rainforest had been like that since primeval time, and she just didn't know it. But the belief that this was a thing that humans could add to the biosphere was really important. And about 15 or 20 years into that process, Deb woke up one morning and thought, oh my God, the Trillion Sensor Hospital, and it's run by not-free software? It's a system for the confinement and colonization of human beings. She got there before the Matrix got there, but it's the same basic legend, right? And so she started to work with me on all kinds of free software-related subversive activity designed to undermine the power of the surveillance capital system as applied to healthcare from creating structures of the kind that you're afraid of. As with me and Stuart Baker on anonymity, we are losing. Pretty bad. And you should not expect any public law bailout to arrive for us. But I know this will seem less comforting to you than it does to me because of our different biological conditions, but you can live to get to Medicare. I look forward to it. The ability of the government to use the Medicare system for that form of compulsory massive surveillance is actually quite low. And law could make it lower. But the reign of the public of the private intermediary financers? Those are the current traffickers in human flesh. And the epidemic greatly improved their powers, not for any reason having to do with this, not the direct surveillance and tracing and contacts, but just through the overwhelming enrichment of those people. Housekeeping is never done. Once upon a time, I thought, if I can just take $84 billion away from Pfizer, the world would be a better place. I was right. And my law partner and I broke the patent on the most profitable pharmaceutical on earth, Lipitor. And we deprived Pfizer of 7 years of patent exclusivity for Lipitor. We thought that would result in the transfer of $70 billion from Pfizer to patients and insurers, because at the time we started that activity, Pfizer was making $10 billion with a B dollars a year from Lipitor. And we smashed 7 years off that life. But it wasn't $70 billion we took from them, because by the time we finished in 2007, Pfizer was making $12 billion. From Lipitor. And all of a sudden, we took it all away. Hank McKinnell, Pfizer's CEO, got fired. You mustn't worry about Mr. McKinnell. He's a director of Moody's, and he earns many hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, and he's fine. But it was a bad moment for Pfizer. And I thought everything is good now. But Pfizer just made $54 billion in 1 year out of COVID. I have to go and do it again. Right, that's the problem that we really have, okay? Yes, I think you're right about all the details. Now let's just move the pieces around on the board a little bit, and then it will really be worrying. Mr. Adams, he's an elected politician in a city with a lot of crime in it, and he's an ex-police captain. He does things in a certain way, and he sees the technology in a certain way. And the consequences of that are complicated and uncertain, but this other thing over here that you wanted to point at, that it's calculable. It's just really, really bad. Is that response? You want more? Okay. The official state is we are already 5 minutes over. I would like to say that the tragedy of the Fourth Amendment is now concluded, and we will move to the happier story of the First Amendment in the 21st century, but I've got a little left to do, so we'll do it next time. See you in a week.